Well, good morning, Morro Bay. Today is Thursday, November 16th, and I'd like to call to order the monthly meeting of the Tourism Business Improvement District. From my right to left, board members present today are Stephen Allen, Charlie Yates, Sean Green, and myself, Aaron Graves, which does give us a quorum to proceed forward. And for the record, the time is 9:03 a.m. First item on the agenda today is board member announcements. Board, do we have any announcements we'd like to make? Plugs, conversations?
I would like to invite everyone to join Savor the Central Coast this weekend at the San Diego Food and Wine Festival. We will be in attendance, Jennifer and I, representing Morro Bay, and the Inn at Morro Bay will be serving about 5,000 servings of local halibut ceviche. So we're pretty excited about that, and that will be a great presence and a great opportunity for us to show the best of Morro Bay. So we're really excited.
Regarding the Christmas event, I just encourage everyone to reach out to restaurateurs, hoteliers, anyone in town that can keep their lights open in the afternoon, evening hours, especially on weekdays, to make the first annual, whatever the new title is, go as successfully as possible.
Excellent. Any other announcements, board? All right, seeing none there, I will mention a few announcements myself. First, our January TBID meeting schedule will be on January 25th from 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. here in the Vets Hall. Changing that very slightly due to Miss Little will be out in Colorado at the time helping to promote our destination. Very excited about her travels. Additionally, a large annual event is the annual shareholders meeting. That will be on March 8th at 9 a.m. here in the Vets Hall. We encourage any member of the population who's interested in tourism, you don't have to even be a specific hotel operator, come down, enjoy our shareholders meeting. We will discuss trials, tribulations, and accomplishments, and what we'd like to see the next year look like. So we, as a board, we represent the community. We want your feedback in this process. Then additionally, I will just mention here under board announcements, quick updates on SLOCAL. And for those of you that are not familiar, that is the destination marketing organization, which represents our entire county. Of course, we as the TBID, we represent the city of Morro Bay. SLOCAL represents the entire county. We just had a board meeting yesterday, so a few of the highlights that came from that meeting, I'll keep this real brief. TOT report from that. Effectively, TOT for the previous month is up very modestly, except for a couple of regions which we know we're going to be hit. Unincorporated area is effectively down almost 20%, and a lot of that is largely because of San Simeon, Cambria region. So I'm going to say this at every meeting. Let's visit our neighbors to the north if we can, do a little staycation up there, go to Ragged Point, have dinner, anything to support them. It is an ecosystem where we rely on one another to keep tourism alive. A couple other quick announcements here that people will appreciate. Our forecast at a county level for next year, we are forecasting a modest occupancy growth of 2.5% and an ADR growth of 2.6%. So not nearly as aggressive as the numbers we have seen. We realize, of course, we need to move these ahead of inflation, but still we are forecasting a small growth as opposed to a retraction. Stay tuned, these things can change monthly. The largest project that we really discussed, well, two, but the primary one that is, we're all very excited about is effectively SLOCAL putting together a destination development strategy. Now at the annual symposium a couple months ago, there were survey results that were sent out. The number one request from this survey result, 84% of the respondents were looking for SLOCAL, the county, to solve for tourism capacity in this county. It's not enough to just put simple heads in beds. There are transportation issues. You land in the airport at midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, which I've done, how do you get public transportation out of there? How do you solve signage issues? So effectively, we are looking to proceed forward with a development strategy which looks at the entire county holistically and what we can do to better enhance the guest experience. At this point right now, we're going out to bid to multiple companies that will aid in this process. So it's in its infancy, but we're very excited about that. And a couple other things here we'll mention. We are discussing cannabis legalization issues at the county level. A lot of what we're going to be looking for is input from individual DMOs. What does each town want to do with this? We realize this is an evolving conversation, so we're going to be looking for feedback on that as well. And then, lastly, we are going to be putting together, hopefully in January, if not February, a destination security discussion. This will be held at one of our, maybe the Embassy Suites. I'm not actually entirely confident on the venue at this point. The purpose of this is to say, to bring in several educators and talk to us as a tourism community. We know there has been a lot of violence that's been spreading across, rampant across the world lately, but surprising in California here. As a destination, how do we want to handle those? What is the education for hoteliers, event spaces, restaurants, and so forth, farmers market, all these events where crowds come together? Let's just tee up that conversation and see as leaders what we can do if something were to happen, that the conversation is the forefront of our minds. So we're going to try to put an educational event together for that. Other boring stuff here. I think that would be sufficient for SloCal. Do we have any public comment? Then add an announcement.
I'd like to announce that the Morro Bay Maritime Museum received its building permit, and we turned our shovel yesterday. We received our lumber. We have our construction fencing up. Dana McClish is the contractor of record, and we are going to be doing a museum raising. So we're very excited about the reality of having a tourism destination, a really incredible museum for everyone to enjoy and to protect and to preserve and to interpret our maritime history here in Morro Bay. So congratulations to that group, and thank you to the city and the building department and everyone for working extra hard to help us get there and make our dream a reality. So exciting days ahead.
Great. Yeah, are there any further board announcements? Seeing none, we'd like to go to staff announcements. And I see somebody who is very, keep it in order here. Staff announcements.
Sure. I'm going to go through just a few things that are currently going on. We have our first tall ship arrives on Thanksgiving Day. It will not be open for tours that day, but it'll be open starting Friday, and the tours are free. So I'd encourage you to let your hotel guests and your neighbors and your friends know about it, and it'll be here till the 12th of December. And Winterfest starts December 1st, and we have a lot going on. I've got posters in the back of the room. If anybody would like to pick them up for your restaurant, retail, or your hotel, would be great. Right now, the kids' passport is currently out. It's doing really well. We're seeing really good redemption, better redemption than we did last year, and that's free for any hotel guest for kids 12 and under. And then I just want to mention Winter Bird Festival is coming up January 12th through 15th. That's coming up quickly. And at that same time, we'll have our restaurant passport that is out for all hotel guests, again, free to hotel guests. And we've got amazingly strong offers this year. So I'm very excited to bring that out. A couple more things. So just going over travel and trade shows that are currently coming up, since I will be out quite a bit. As Charlie mentioned, we have Savor on the Road this coming weekend down at San Diego. And then Go West in Salt Lake City is January 16th through the 19th. That's why we're moving the January meeting. And then in May, I will be at IPW in the SloCal booth. So that'll be good. It did really well. Both those did really well for us last year. So that's all my announcements. Questions?
No, thank you. Are there any further staff announcements? Seeing none, we will open it up to public comment. I see an eager citizen out there.
A faux turkey. Nancy Castle, I am here to talk about Thanksgiving. Well, the community dinner is well underway in its planning, and will be a delightful dinner of classic traditional fare for Turkey Day, particularly for this group, but encourage the hoteliers, and especially if people are looking for something to do Thanksgiving Day, encourage them to come down to the meal. We gratefully accept donations, but it's a good meal and a good party, and they'll get to see a slice of Morro Bay that happens once a year. It's 1 to 3 Thanksgiving Day. Everybody is welcome. It's free or donation. And we also have meals that can be delivered. The police department and the volunteers for the police department take meals out. And if you know of somebody who needs a meal, let them know. And they can call the senior center at 772-4421 to get on the list for getting a meal delivered. And it's a great celebration of Morro Bay's love for its community. So perhaps we'll see you there. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy, and thank you for your efforts. Is there any further public comment? Seeing none, we will close that portion. First item, and only item on the consent agenda, is approval of the September 21st TBID board meeting minutes. Board, do we have any thoughts or discussion on the TBID minutes? No?
I'll make a motion to approve.
Okay. We have a motion from Mr. Allen. Do we have a second?
I'll second that.
All right. Is there any public comment on the motion that's been made? Seeing no public comment, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Motion passes 4-0. Right. First item on the business agenda. Public draft site and ordinance be presented by Community Development Officer, Mr. Scott Graham.
Thank you, Chair Graves and members of the board. We have a presentation for you this morning on the city's sign ordinance update. We've been working on this for a while. Before we hop into there, I wanted to provide a point of clarification related to the staff report that was passed out. Chair Graves had pointed out a potential discrepancy between a table on page 3 and the table that is attachment B to the staff report. Those tables are in fact separate entities. The table on page 3 is related to community comments that we received at one of our sign forums. And then there's a staff action and it reflects what we did after the forum. But final changes to the ordinance, which would have been after our planning commission meeting, which was later, are denoted in attachment B. That can be kind of confusing, and moving forward in this process, I'll be adding titles to these to make it very clear that they're not one and the same, because I was sort of confused when you brought it to my attention. So we need to fix that, but it is the table that's on page 3 of the staff report is related to comments that we received from our forums, and then the table on attachment B is the current status of where are we at in the sign ordinance update, what have we done to this point, and this will be based on the last input that we received from Planning Commission. That was after the forums took place. And I'll touch on all of that in the staff report so it'll become clear why that's important and to differentiate between the two. Moving on, some history. This effort to update the sign ordinance actually started in 2010. We're very fast. The city council initiated this as an important goal for the planning division to take on back then. We started workshops in 2011, had several of them, and then commenced with some planning commission meetings through 2012 and 2013. There was a handful of those as well. And then we created, out of this effort, sort of created some districts, and I'll show you those a little bit later on in the presentation. And then presented the findings from the previous work to those districts. And then everything kind of set, fallow for a while. We weren't doing anything with it because there was a lot of churn and turnover in the planning division at the time. It wasn't the community development department, it was under public services department. And while that sort of pause in the action was taking place, they hired me. The Supreme Court made a ruling related to signage, and it prohibits us from having content-based signage, and our ordinance was largely based on content-based regulations, which was a problem. So when I came on board, we picked this up, and we needed to start moving forward and removing the content-based pieces out of the ordinance, and that was no small task. We did all of that, revised the ordinance, had two public forums. In August. And then we met with the Planning Commission to get final input from them before we went to council in October. And so after I did that, it was brought to my attention by Lori that TBID had requested a future agenda item to be to review the sign ordinance, which I think was a good idea. And so we did this a little bit out of order. We went to Planning Commission before we went to you. I am happy to take whatever input the board would like to give me And when we move forward to council, I will present that information or direction, whatever that might be, to the council as well. So
thank you. Scott, I don't mean to kill your momentum, but just to be clear then on these two charts, the one that was here in the TBID packet, page 73 and so forth, this grid, would this be an accurate representation of the ordinance as it is proposed today?
Is page...
Yeah, the one that you're holding your hand at this very moment.
This is current status. And this is related to, you know, it has, that table has what the regulation is, what the current code says,
sure,
what the 2013 draft said, and then what present day draft says. And that other table was related strictly to input that was provided by the forum and what, if any, action staff took moving forward. This is the latest and greatest.
Okay, so do not rely on this one that's in the page, the front of the packet at page 9. We buried way back to the end here in the mid-70s. This would be accurate representation.
That's the correct thing.
Okay, for all those out there. Thank you.
All right. So I talked briefly about the Supreme Court ruling, and it was Reed versus Town of Gilbert. And I gave you, there's a couple of examples in... I'll give you a couple of examples of content-based regulations that were in the existing sign code, I believe. And one of them relates to restaurant sign menus, and it says, in addition to those signs permitted by this chapter, a restaurant may display a sign not to exceed 3 square feet in area on a wall or window, which displays the menu and or daily specials. You have to look at that sign to see whether it's a menu sign or whether it displays daily specials to determine what it is. If the regulation makes you do that, then it's not legal. We've had to remove all of that out of the ordinance. Again, that was no small task. We got together, myself, the then chair of the Planning Commission, Bob Teft, and our intern, Ryan Russell. We spent several weeks kind of going through everything and revising everything we thought. When we had it right where we thought we wanted it, we sent it off to the city attorney's office. We were very proud, patted ourselves on the back. What a great job we did. We sent it to them, and they sent it back with 94 corrections. So even though we thought we knew where we were going, apparently we didn't. But we took all those 94 changes back or clarifications from the city attorney's office and rolled them into the current ordinance that you see now. We had I mentioned the public forums that we had on August 3rd and August 24th. Out of those came the items that you see on the board, and that was related to lodging. They didn't want any illuminated sign time limitations. Right now, the ordinance has limitations that the sign illumination is turned off at 10 p.m. or when the business closes, whichever is sooner. Makes a lot of sense. You probably don't want your lodging folks turning their signs off at night. If your people are pulling in at night, they'd probably like to see where you're at, so we removed that. It didn't originally allow marquee signs, but, you know, several of our hotel folks have them, and, you know, they put all kinds of nice messages up, and I think those are a positive thing for us. What we did add was minimum sign size requirements for them, just so we're not having really small signs. That was an issue that we see out in the city right now, is people put up a lot of really small signs that don't serve the purpose. You can't read them. So we put some minimum size requirements in for those. And then there was some concern about neon signs not being allowed, you know, like open and close signs, that type of thing. But they are allowed in the code, so part of that clarification. There was some issues that came up specifically in relation to gas stations, and they have a lot of regulatory requirements for you know, requirements that have to be posted at the site. Related to gas station pumps, and even like our car wash over on Morro Bay Boulevard, right? There's a thing that sits over the top and says height, you know, going under it is 8.5 feet or whatever it says. We don't want to include that in a business sign square footage limitations because those are valuable, and we don't want them not having those signs out there. So those are exempt signs in our code, so you don't have to count those. There was the request to allow internally lit signs in the downtown on the Embarcadero. And then again, to extend the time limits for sign illumination in the downtown. Didn't like the 10 p.m. cutoff or when the business closes. There was some desire to allow signs to be turned on all the time because folks felt it was dark in the downtown. I'll speak more to that a little bit later after we get to the Planning Commission piece. So again, in October, we went to the Planning Commission. They it was well, the ordinance was well received. The major discussion points were related to internally illuminated signage in the downtown and the Embarcadero. They don't want it. So business owners in our forum did want internally illuminated signage. Our planning commission doesn't want those, and so while you, and it would make all of the existing internally illuminated signs non-conforming, you would be able to keep those. But once they required major maintenance, they would have to be replaced, and any new businesses coming in would have to have signage that wouldn't be internally illuminated. They'd have to be illuminated from the exterior. And those would be, and that'd be before, and those limitations are for the downtown and the Embarcadero. They would not apply to Quintana or North Main. And then there's no, and there's a request to have no type of illumination on signage facing the waterfront. So we've made those changes as well. That kind of makes sense, actually. And then the idea behind all this is to sort of preserve the concept of dark sky, whereas you don't have a bunch of light pollution going up into the air. So the issue that was raised by the business community when we had our forums about, you know, needing more lighting in the downtown, and the signs provide that, that's not the way you want to light your downtown. I mean, if we have a lighting issue and people want to, you know, have more lighting in the downtown, we need to solve that through lighting solutions, not signage, bright signage. That's not the way you would do that. So that might be a discussion for the future. Like if people have that concern, then we could go down that road and pursue and look at options for providing better lighting in the downtown. So moving into the sign standards, this is a portion of the table that's at the back that we talked about a minute ago at the back in attachment B, and it talks about you know, where we went with some of these items. The first item at the top talks about the regulation and talks about sign districts. In the current code, we don't have sign districts. In 2013, they created them, as I mentioned before, and those remain in the current ordinance. This one might have a better prohibited. So this one, top one up there, talks about prohibited signs, and there was a list of prohibited signs in the current code. That was the same in the 2013 code. We removed those prohibited type signs in the present code and created performance standards for them, and created, so the current code is different in its formation, mostly because you have a list, and then what happens if something isn't on the list? And that wasn't great. So it's better to have performance standards. Either you meet them or you don't, and then makes things a little easier to deal with from that standpoint. And it also allows for different types of signage that we haven't thought of to be allowed out there. If a list of allowed types of signage and prohibited types of signage, if something doesn't fall in there, decisions have to be made that are not really dealt with in the code. So performance standards is a much better way to do it. Here are the sign districts. There's four of them. Okay, page 11 in your packet. So you have the downtown in green. You have the Embarcadero in yellow along the waterfront, obviously. North Main's in red, and the Quintana area is in blue. Here's just a close-up of the downtown area, Embarcadero. And then, okay, so we grouped some of the sign requirements to give you an example of how we calculate sign square footages in these areas. So for the downtown and the Embarcadero, it equates to 15% of your facade, or on the Embarcadero, 120 square feet, whichever is less. And in the downtown, it would be 15% of your facade, or 150 square foot, whichever is less. And then if you have a secondary facade, you can use 5% of that for signage as well. So if you have a structure that's on a corner, say, or even one that's exposed and might have an alley or a driveway next to it, we'd probably consider that a secondary frontage and allow you to have signage there too, because it makes sense, especially if you were putting it at a pedestrian level or something, as people see those when you're walking down the road, they're pretty effective. So Quintana, North Main, the requirements in those areas a little bit different. 20% of the facade, or 200 square feet, whichever is less. The secondary facades have a different requirement for them. On Quintana, it's 10%, and on North Main, it's 5%. Just based on kind of the businesses that we have in those locations and how some of those locations are viewable from the highway along Quintana. And a lot of the development and the businesses that are along, portions of it at least, are geared towards the highway. We have sign district examples. This one's out of the, I believe this is the Quintana district. I need to get over to it in my slide deck here. Example, there's minimum, we have minimum and maximum square footages. This kind of speaks to that issue that I brought up earlier. We have a lot of signs, especially down on the Embarcadero. They put up these little tiny signs that you can't read, either when you're driving by or you literally have to stop in front of it to read it if you're walking by it. And so we found that to be an issue, and so we wanted to address it. And so now we have minimum and maximums, both, so it gives, so you at least have signage that's readable. We didn't used to allow marquees, the second one down there, and so now we do. And then it has items for minimum sizes for things like marquees and wall signs and hanging signs, things like that. We have a separate district for lodging establishments, so separate requirements that apply to them. On the table? I don't think we had a slide. I don't think we had a page on it initially. I think we just spoke to it. So this brings up some of the issues. Again, no lighting time limits unless adjacent to a residential district. And then we're actually working on that currently, because the Planning Commission had some suggestions, and we're still sort of working through what that's going to look like. Because you would still want to be able to have it lighted, and so we might have some limitations on an Kelvin scale about how bright they can be, so it's not detrimental to the adjacent residential neighborhood, but you can still see it. So we're probably going to have a kind of a limitation that goes in with that.
Because a number of the lodging properties are adjacent to a residential district, really.
They are, yeah. And so we saw this as an issue, okay. And said, well, we don't want to... I agree, we should have the lights should be on, because mm-hmm. people come in at all hours of the night, and so... If we have a brightness limitation on them, then
I want to say in somewhere in here I saw 10 candle power.
That is for some of them, yeah. And so okay. That might be where we go. They requested that we use a Kelvin scale. Planning Commission suggested that. So we're looking into that. We haven't finalized all the research on it yet.
But I thought Kelvin scale is frequency, where candle power is brightness. Right? Isn't that two different conversations?
It's both. You can do it both ways. There's a third measurement as well that we're looking into. That's what I'm saying. We're looking into how best to do it and how it makes the most sense. And we weren't really up on how we measure all those and what the best requirements were. And so we had to do research, and we're in the middle of that right now. And then again, we weren't allowing marquee signs, and we now have that in there and do allow them in the neon signs. It was kind of unclear whether they were allowed or not. We expressly allowed them, especially for like open and closed type signage and that type of thing. We have sign bonuses. Sign bonuses are kind of a neat thing in the code. This is really to incentivize quality signs, and it allows you to have, like if you have businesses that are set back far from the road, you can get, like if you're over 30 foot back from the road, maybe your signage, you get a sign bonus, so you can have more signage that sits out by the road so people can see it and see where you're at, as opposed to just on the face of your building, because if you're sitting way back from the road, maybe people won't see it. And so it allows up to a 20 square foot bonus for situations like that. If your wall sign is individually lettered, we give you a bonus of 10 square feet, so you can get some additional signage that way. And then if it's you have window lettering, as opposed to having it all kind of blocked out on the window, if you have individual letters on your windows, you get a 5 square foot bonus that you could add signage that way too. Because that type of lettering and signage looks neat, crisp, and clean. And so we want to incentivize people using that, and you get a little bit of extra, so maybe you could have a little bit larger of a sign that way if you wanted, or larger letters than you would otherwise be allowed there, because it does look nicer. Some of the changes that we did make, although some of these do date back to the 2013 version of this, we require master sign programs for any multi-tenant building. And so you'll have to come in and get a master sign program. We're going to pick that up as part of the business licenses as they come in. That's actually how we're going to enforce our sign code, to bring folks up to standards. Like if you have too many signs, too much square footage, non-permitted signs, as you come in to re-up your business license, we're going to evaluate your property. One of the issues that's come up out of the general plan, and it's been repeated for all of the outreach that we've done, is that the city could look nicer. And a lot of the places have too many signs, it looks cluttered, doesn't look clean, crisp, inviting, you can't read the signs, things like that. So we've took that to heart in trying to craft policies that allow the types of signs that we need, but don't have too many of them, and then place them in locations where they're readable, makes sense in the locations where they would be located, that type of thing. And we do have additional signs that are allowed in our shopping centers and those types of things, allow some additional signage there. So you could have a monument outside, out front, that has a list of all the businesses that are in that center, maybe, and those types of things. And so and that's included in the master sign program process. Examples of additional type of signage, again, are monument style signs, and they're in it for shopping centers and retail clusters and professional offices. And you've seen examples of that not only all over town, but probably everywhere you go in commercial areas. It's not uncommon. We've changed our non-conforming sign policy. You have legal non-conforming, we have unpermitted, and then ones that are outright illegal. This will come into play when we go through that enforcement process, when we start renewing business license. It's going to be a big effort up front, but in a year we'll be done. So it's worthwhile ramping up to get things cleaned up, and then things should look a lot nicer. We're probably in that time frame. Also, we're working behind the scenes on probably for that first year, reducing sign permit fees, so it's not too onerous on people. If we're going to go get you, we might as well facilitate you getting your permit to make it, bring it into compliance.
Is the enforcement program going to be similar to the building call in, report it, or is it going to be an active?
Some of it will be that, but we're going to, as I was saying, when you have to renew your business license every year, and so when that renewal comes in, we're going to send out either a planner or a code enforcement folks, and they'll come out, look at the site, take a picture of all the signs that you have, go back, look at the address file, do you have permits for any of these? Many of them won't, because I think last year we had applications for about 5 sign permits. That's really low. And we had, you know, many businesses change out, so there's a lot of signs out there that haven't been approved. And so that's why I said we want to reduce the fee, so it's just come in, let's get you in compliance, and it costs you a little bit of money, but not a bunch, not the regular full sign permit fee. Because we're going to be going after, we don't want to make it, you know, super unpleasant, but the idea is to be somewhat friendly.
I know, as an entrepreneur and a small business owner, I love the idea of sending in my business license application, and I know the trucks are going to show up in a few days, but you've got to do it to start confirmation. I get it.
I think we're able to do it pretty fast.
Okay.
We'll be able to probably get out on site, within a couple of days of the application coming in. So we should be able to go out there, look, it's a quick go back, do the research, and then we would be contacting them probably by phone, saying, hey, we want to get you up and rolling, but we see this issue with your sign, you need to come in and give us an application for it. So they'd have to maybe measure the signs that they have, and maybe they have too many or what have you, and then we'd go over what the requirements are. We're going to probably attach like a memo on top of the renewal applications and the notices that we send out that say this is happening, so people aren't surprised, because we do send notices. We want to let everybody know. And probably, we've been looking at, we've been discussing sending out a utility bill mailers related to businesses, so to let them know up front too, just to give everybody a warning that we're doing this, so they can talk to us ahead of time if they want, and hopefully bring things into compliance maybe in front of when we start enforcing.
Scott, I'm sorry, can you go one slide back, please? And can you please really define for us these three types of non-conforming signs: are legal non-conforming, are unpermitted, and are illegal? At what point does something go from non-conforming to illegal?
So illegal would be just a sign type that's just not allowed by the code. And there's no way to permit it, and you're not supposed to have it, and it was never legal by the code. An unpermitted sign would just simply be what I talked about. We only had 5 sign applications last year that came in. There's probably 30 new signs that were put up in town. And so it's simply unpermitted. You can probably come in and get a permit for the sign that you put up. Other non-conforming would be the policy changes and you had a legal sign before and now it's changed, made it non-conforming. Or you have a legacy sign that's been there for a very long time. We can see that it's been there for a very long time. We're kind of unclear on what happened with it or whatnot, and we would just consider that legal non-conforming.
So effectively grandfathering those in.
Yeah.
Okay.
It does do that, except, you know, when you get to the point where you're doing a huge redo of the sign, reconstructing it basically, when you get to that level, then you're probably going to have to bring it into compliance. Whereas if you had like a cabinet box type sign that had the plastic slide-ins with the thing on it, if you're just replacing those, you probably can do that. If you're like, oh, I got to take the cabinet off and rebuild the whole cabinet because it's rusting out and we don't allow those anymore,
So
for the constituency out there, is there like a percentage of rebuild? Because I've replaced plenty of those plastic panels in a box, and while you're in there, frankly, you are going to change on some electrical components so that they understand where they're at in this. Are we talking 75% redo, 20%?
It is. I wrote the page down here. Hold on a second. It's on page 44 of the ordinance. Get with the changed this several times, so just give me a second.
Sure, take your time.
I thought it was 50% of the value of the sign, but yeah, that's what I was looking. Oh, there it is. Yeah, okay. Deterioration. When a non-conforming sign becomes deteriorated or dilapidated to the extent over 50% of the physical value, it would have to be maintained. Value. This is a typo. It would have, if it had been maintained in good repair, it must be removed within 60 days of receiving a notice. This would also come in when they came in to get a building permit to change out the, you know, the sign or what have you. We pick it up. So it's 50% of the value is kind of the limitation.
So effectively, to erect a new sign, it's 10 grand, and they're doing over $5,000 in revision work. Then it needs to be conforming at that point.
Yeah, I mean, so when this normally, so when this would normally happen is, and it's kind of the example that I gave is, you're changing out the plastic sheets because the business changed out, and you have the can out front. Knock yourself out.
Okay.
You need to change out the ballast in the sign because it's flashing, because it's going out. Fine, change out the ballast. That's, you know, I mean, that's going to be a $200 project or something that you're paying someone to do. Whatever.
I wish it was $200, but yeah.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, you know what I mean? It's not yeah, several thousand dollars typically.
Right.
If you have a big sign, it's more, but if it's on the ground, it's not that expensive. You know, but the situation where that can sign now is corroded and rusted out and you have to basically reconstruct it. Well, now you're reconstructing it. And at that point, that's when we probably say, now you need to bring it up to meet the code requirements.
Okay.
So
that's pretty clear. Thank you.
Okay.
Scott, could you clarify what age would determine grandfathering? I mean, some signs, I'm guessing, are 30, 40 years old out there.
So, I mean, there's enough flexibility in the code for us to work with folks because we have some indications that would predate, some signs that we have around town actually predate when we were incorporated. They're that old. And so those types of situations, I don't know how they were permitted, but they were here when the city became a city, at which point, okay, you're there. And until you come into one of those, you're doing the major rehab of it or something, that's when it would come into the point where we'd have to have a conversation about whether it can remain or not. There was a conversation on the part of the Planning Commission a while ago about, you know, having lists of historic signs in town that maybe could stay. So that's another conversation we're having as it relates to the overall zoning code update and general plan. It's come up a couple of times in that process. And so we may actually have a list that, you know, and we'll have to amend this accordingly, that identifies several of those types of signs, and so we don't have to worry about it. We're like, yep, all these signs are okay, and they can stay. We haven't done that yet. But we're in the middle of updating, as you're probably aware, the city's general plan, local coastal program, and zoning code. That's ongoing, and right now, we're just now starting to talk about that type of policy. So that might change before we're done with the sign ordinance. If it does, it'll get updated. This, when we're done with the sign code, we're gonna take it to council, show it to them, and then we're going to take it back and hold it for the zoning code update because Coastal doesn't want us. They have to certify this, and Coastal doesn't want to see. Well, they want to see everything together at one time. So we're supposed to be done with the update in August of next year. We can go until December of next year, depending on how long it takes. We have deliverables that are due then, so it might be a little bit longer, but it'll be plugged into the zoning code piece.
Thank you. And I should know this, but what year was the city incorporated? 64. Okay, so roughly anything pre-64 would be grandfathered, legal, non-conforming.
And we actually have several signs like that have been around for since then. So, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So here's some ideas and pictures of what we're trying to avoid. You know, lots of pole signs, lots of clutter of signage. you know, you don't even know what you're supposed to be looking at there. Your eye's not drawn to anything in particular. It's just like a mess, quite frankly. We have these, next slide I think has stuff in the city, examples. Well, you have a bunch of pole signs running down the street trying to avoid that. That's the corner of Rose's Landing right there, and you see a whole bunch of small signs. You can't even tell what's going on there. And it's because it's so cluttered, you wouldn't know what to look at anyway when you're walking by. It just becomes kind of background noise. That's not good or effective signage, and so the sign code kind of deals with those types of things and has you create separation. And it's one of the reasons we came up with minimum size types, because some of those are so small that they're just completely ineffective.
At the moment, all A-frames are prohibited. Is that right?
They're prohibited now. We have them all over town.
Yeah.
But we're now going to be allowing them, except not in the Embarcadero. The Embarcadero is heavily pedestrian traveled, and putting those types of signs out there create hazards. And so we're going to expressly prohibit them down. They're in the code as it stands right now. They're expressly prohibited.
And are they prohibited on public sidewalks as well? Public sidewalks in that need the 3 feet ADA everywhere.
Yeah, they wouldn't be allowed in those locations. We're probably going to come up with a separate ordinance that talks about where you can put these things. Because we've had some requests by several of our business owners. Several of them already have these. They're unpermitted outdoor displays. And so with that, we're going to come up with a policy that says where you can put these, and they can't be on sidewalks. They literally need to be on your property. But you can think about, like, in the downtown where you could have them. You can't have them on the Embarcadero, but in the downtown you can. But a lot of the businesses in the downtown are right at the front of the property line. So then they do end up in the sidewalk. That's not okay. But it could be okay, if we, you know, put together a display type ordinance. And as long as you have the clearance to get by, it might be acceptable if you have a small area where you could either put one of these or a little bit of a display of merchandise that you have. But it's going to be a very small area that has to be maintained to. It's something that's easy for code enforcement folks as they're driving through town to look over and go, they're fine, you know, that type of thing.
So when you say a defined area out front, because I do understand a small business, they have the special of the day, things like that, that they are changing out so rapidly that, frankly, an A-frame sign is probably a very efficient way to do that. Mm-hmm. Would they just have a designated spot on the sidewalk that's permitted to do so, or are you thinking a different sign altogether?
It could. We do have some signs that don't count against your square footage, and one of them would account for a small sign that's on your wall. It's a minimum sign size, but it's on your wall that you could have your menu stuff on. It could be in there. You could slide it in and out. It would work fine for that. Okay. And it's encouraged, so you place it on the building. And it gives you, and again, it's free. It doesn't count towards your overall sign square footage for things just like that. But if they do want to have them on the A-frame, I wanted to be able to come up with a policy that allowed them to place it out there if there was room. And so that's the display ordinance that we're going to kind of come up with in the future. We have one that's been adopted, ordinance resolution, not an ordinance, in the downtown area, and you have to come in and get liability insurance to do it. And I don't know that we've issued any of them. It was approved many, many years ago. We do a process for people to go through. I just don't know that we've ever issued any. I've not seen examples of them. So we're going to take that and make it easier for folks, and then have a delineated space where it could be, and while still maintaining the clearances that you need. Radia and that type of thing.
Okay.
So, the idea here is accommodate what the types of advertising people want to have, but also getting rid of things like on the corner there where you have it's really busy and, you know, that's not effective signage. So, trying to promote, attractive type signs in the town. Castaways is an example. Here's some signs that are nice and good examples. You have the one on the bike shop with it's off the edge. We have, those types of signs are encouraged. It's kind of unique. It's got the rim sticking off of it, that type of thing. We have several signs in town that are like that. They're kind of interesting.
Scott, I'm sorry, one slide back, please. Bike shop, rentals, $20 a day. Is that part of the ordinance at all, or is that a window display?
Window signs are accounted for in the ordinance.
Yeah, okay.
So the idea is you get a total overall amount of square footage of signage, and then there's some that you get for free. You know, if you have those types of signs, you can use them like the menu board sign that you have out front. You at a certain size, you can have that. It doesn't count against your square footage. It's like a pub type sign, that's what they're called. So that would count against your overall sign square footage. But the idea is, here's the overall square footage. Here's the types of signs and the locations you can have them. It's up to you where you want to put them, the type that you want to have. It's just once you get to that 120 square feet, say, you're done. So you can't have any more than that unless you have one of the ones that's exempt or something. So if that's the type of signage that you want, then it's going to count. If you're going to have something like that and it changes out regularly or whatever, then that's fine. It's just your sign above it's probably going to be a little smaller to account for that, because you only get the maximum total of the 120 or what have you, whatever the number is, based on your frontage percent. So that's pretty much it. It's questions now, or more questions if you have
questions.
Could you clarify going forward for lodging establishments, interior illuminated signs, would there be a moratorium?
It's moving forward. This would not take effect until the ordinance is adopted. I gave you the timelines on certification and that type of thing, because my guess is, you know, we're probably going to send this off less towards August and more towards the end of next year, because Coastal Commission is short-staffed right now, and we're having a little bit of a difficulty getting information and input back from them on the update. So I don't see that changing anytime soon. They're not even recruiting to fill the position of the planner that they had that was working in our area for the cities in San Luis Obispo County. Found that out 2 weeks ago. That was not great news. So I'm going to say it's going to be more towards the end of that time frame, and it'll probably take 6 months for certification after that. So now you're talking 2019 June. I don't plan on doing anything, you know, with any of this until then.
Right, but could you?
Nor are we really, you know, out there actively enforcing on the current code, because I don't know, the code's going to change. I wouldn't want to go enforce on something and make it go away if I don't have to. And then all of a sudden now it's permitted in the code. That's not a good look. It's not fair, really. I mean.
Right, but what I'm trying to clarify, it said that marquee and neon signs would be allowable for lodging establishments. Mm-hmm. Interior illuminated signs, the proposal would be complete moratorium, though, including lodging.
It's not a moratorium. It would just get rid of the it wouldn't be allowed anymore. So when you came in, so the new hotel that comes in isn't going to have an internally illuminated sign if it comes in after June of 2019. If it comes in before that, then they could have it, and then it would just be existing nonconforming once the policy changed. I would imagine, you know, once this is in place, though, and somebody's coming through the process, say, to build a new hotel, and they have to have their sign information submitted as part of their approval process, that the Planning Commission would be like, yeah, we don't want those. And there'd probably be some indication, because then they'd be spending money on something that maybe they can't maintain. So I would imagine there'd be some pushback on that once the ordinance is kind of where it's going to be when we're done with it. So.
On the Embarcadero, businesses and hotels have a disincentive to highlight or feature their coastal access and public restroom signs. Is that part of, is that Coastal Commission jurisdiction or an R enforcement, or how does that handle?
So, it's not part of this. Other than those types of signs are recognized in the ordinance, they're recognized as exempt signs. They're signs that are required by the state or the government, the city, those types of things, they're exempt. How that stuff is enforced, and we've gone through enforcement on a few of the Embarcadero properties, is when issues are brought to our attention, when we see them, we'll send code enforcement out or a planner, we'll go out and look at it, and we'll go and go through what was permitted, what's supposed to be out there, and then make them replace signage that they've gotten rid of. We make them open back up public access paths that they didn't have. We did that with Giovanni's recently. Well, recently, a little over a year ago. They had their public access path closed off and the signage was gone. We made them put the signage back up and open it back up. Gio was great working with, though. He was like, you're totally right. We'll open it back up. But they're, you know, they were doing fish unloading operations there, and his issue was from liability standpoint. And so we said, well, when you're doing that, close the gate. You know, I mean, you can do that. That's fine. We don't want you to hurt people. So that's how we kind of came to the compromise and got it open back up. And so now you can walk back behind his business over there. And the signs are on the gate. When the gate's closed, you don't see the sign because they're operating. So mostly they've helped with that and been pretty good since then. We have other scenarios where the bathrooms aren't identified correctly, or they don't have all of the signs they're supposed to have up. I've walked recently, because we're doing the general plan and LCP updates, and we're doing the lateral access component of that is underway right now. Walked all of the lease sites several times now, and there's a lot of them that aren't into compliance. We have kind of a list of those types of things, and we're going to be hitting them up probably a little bit later on down the road. But we are tracking it now, and because we had to walk them, we didn't want to waste that time. So we're actually doing some research into some of that, because there's a list, and making sure that it is correct or it's not, and what's not correct. So we can go work with the business owners to make it right.
I have a list, but I didn't want to cut people off. Sir, change of ownership. So let's say let's keep it as simple as that. What are your thoughts on that? How will that be perceived? Say it's year 2022, everything's adopted.
Change of ownership's fine. Doesn't really create any issues other than, so by then we'll have gone through and theoretically, most of the signs in town will be in compliance because after the first year, we implement the sign, we'll be going out on all the sites, every single site, as a business license comes up and seeing whether they're in compliance and then bringing those businesses into compliance. And so by then, you know, it'll be in place. I've been in place hopefully for a year, if we're lucky. And it'll just change hands and there won't be any issue. We would look at, so when a business does change hands, it does come through us, does come through me. I do review it. And usually there's not a whole lot of commentary about it unless I know there's some issue at that property and then maybe we reach out and say, hey, can we have a conversation? But other than that, I don't see there being any issue really. If it was earlier on in the process and it changed hands and we hadn't gotten to their renewing their business license, well, then we might have the conversation then.
But effectively every year during business license renewal anyways, it's going to happen. So the change of ownership really will not be the catalyst for this. It'll be the annual renewal.
It will be. And I said, after we go through a year, most of the businesses will be in compliance and there will be a lot less of issues out there. You know, we'll still go out and look when it happens. And maybe they'll have, some sign they're not supposed to have that they put out there or they have too many window signs or whatever, but it'll be a fairly minor process to bring folks into alignment. And once they know we're doing this on a regular basis, then we'll have less of an issue with it.
Okay. Then you're talking about no internal illumination on businesses that are in the Embarcadero in the downtown area, but that is okay in other zones, correct?
It would be okay on North Main and on Quintana, yeah.
That seemed kind of counterintuitive to me that Embarcadero and downtown is supposed to be our cultural heartbeat, if you will, for the town. Wouldn't we want that to be better lit and more vibrant?
Idea is in those locations you have businesses that are oriented towards the highway. More of those.
Okay.
And so having them not have the illumination, it can be somewhat of a detriment to depending on what the business is.
Okay. I follow the exception there.
Yeah.
Then to be perfectly clear then, moving forward, a lot of the existing signs, it's the year 2022 again, you're going to do the business license renewal. Therefore, after that, anything that's been grandfathered or is non-conforming, you're going to let most of those lie, right?
You'll get to stay there. It won't be until they do a major reconstruction of the sign that we would get engaged. And anytime you're doing a major reconstruction, I mean, that's building permit time and those types of things, so that's how we would probably pick that up, or we would see them.
Okay, because I know that'd be a tremendous scare for the constituency, is that all of a sudden you show up, it's a good performing sign, and then there's something that needs to be changed. That can be very expensive.
And we wouldn't want to do that. You're correct. Signs are very expensive.
Tremendous.
Just even the cabinet type signs are very expensive. I totally get that. It's afforded in the ordinance. We deal with that. It's just when it's deteriorated to such an extent that it basically needs to be reconstructed. Okay, well, when you're going to do that, you're going to need to put a new sign in that's compliant.
I get that process. So then everything passes. It's 5-10 years from now. You consider that to be a business disadvantage for new hotel properties or tremendous gentrification on an old property. They have to do new sign that really is inferior to their neighbors.
Well, I mean, you're saying inferior. I mean, exterior lighted signs are actually kind of nice. There's a lot of examples of exterior lighted signs that I see out there that are really attractive. They look fairly high-end and very polished, and there's a specific look that goes along with them. So it just kind of depends on what that sign looks like. And exterior illumination could be backlit letters, which is also kind of cool. See a lot of, I've seen a lot of hotels that have that in various areas. They look very nice. Or they have the lights that come out and illuminate it from the front, that type of thing. Just sort of depends on how they choose to do it.
So to be real clear then, figure 17.2 from the TBID packet, it was in page 24 overall for the packet. You have, by the way, this is great examples here, the different types of signage, correct?
So these are, we have internally lit types and then externally lit types, yeah.
So the internally illuminated are definitely no, but backlit would be okay in a new development project 5-10 years from now.
Yeah.
Filament lamp would not.
Which one?
Just kind of going down this visual aid here.
Yeah, that
No, that would probably be acceptable with the code.
That would be acceptable with the code. Yeah. Neon would be acceptable with the code. With a
neon's allowed in the code, yeah.
LED would be fine, as well as externally illuminated.
Yeah.
So really, just to be clear, only the internally illuminated would not be okay in a new project.
Correct.
So you could still add light and vibrancy to your new sign on your new project 5 years from now.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. A couple of the quick questions. Would there be any variances allowed or waivers in this process, or is the code just going to be fixed, said, and done?
Variances, yeah, you'd have to go through a regular variance process, and that would be the Planning Commission. And the problem is, so variances, the findings that you have to make are not city findings. They're findings that are set up by the state. And so you have to have something unique that's to your property that doesn't apply to others. And usually that's a physical feature. You're on a very steep slope, you have a very large boulder, and you need a variance to a setback because you can't develop your property to the setbacks because you have this issue that's in the way. And so you get a variance so you can move it over maybe into a setback to have a house that's similar in size to the ones around you. That's an example of it. I don't know how the sign variance would work much. Those probably wouldn't necessarily apply, at least not easily.
Okay.
Certainly there are probably things I can't think of, but yeah, you'd have to go through that process. And so it's a little more rigorous, of a process when you're asking for a variance to a policy.
Okay. Just trying to get an idea of how concrete this is. So it sounds like it's pretty well locked down.
Mm-hmm.
You do have an amortization schedule in here as well that references the time frame allowed under $500, 90 days, and so on and so forth. It can pushed out as much as 2 years if it's a cost of $5,000 or more, I want to say. In that specific situation, is there a hardship or something that could be filed on behalf of the business owner that financially it's detrimental to the business and then they would get some 5-year extension or something?
We don't. So that's an interesting question. We don't have the policy specifically written in here. That might be something worth pursuing. I've seen that in other ordinances.
I have too, right.
So that might not be a bad idea to have something like that in there, because otherwise then it has to be up to me. And while I usually try to work with folks, that's not something specifically in there, and you want to be careful about how much you deviate from policies, because you want to be fair to everyone. You want to apply the code consistently across the board. So that might be something we could consider putting in there. That's not a bad idea. So
I think that would be a nice idea for some of the small business owners. It truly may become a tremendous imposition for them to meet the new code. And I don't know what metric you'd use to do so, but it seems like at least, even if there's not specific metrics, just a paragraph that at least gives the option for the community development officer to give a hardship, if you will. And that is the extent of my question list. So what is it you're looking for us from us today right now?
Like I said, all your comments, concerns, changes you'd like to see. Because right now, like I said, the best case scenario would have been I went to you before I went to Planning Commission. Our Planning Commission is our land use authority, and they make recommendations to City Council. But I'm glad that I found out, because otherwise I wouldn't have gotten any input from the board, and I'd much rather have it than not. So I'll take whatever you want to give me. I've been taking notes on the items that you brought forward. I like the idea of the extension on the amortization schedule. Actually, I'm going to look into putting some policy in there for that. That's a good idea. And so when I present it to council, I'll say this is where the Planning Commission went with it. This issue didn't come up before, although it did talking to individuals out there now that I think about it. And the TBID board was interested in that, and we've actually drafted a policy to put in there. City Council, what do you think? And it would be my recommendation that they go with that. I think it's a good idea. So.
We have any other thoughts for him, gentlemen?
All right.
No?
All right, thank you.
All right. Scott, thank you for coming, giving almost an hour-long presentation on this topic. It's huge. It's important. And we know you're a busy guy. AV, I think we'll take a quick 5-minute break, allow us to turn over, and we will pick this meeting back up at 10:08. Thank you. All right, well, welcome back. Thank you all for indulging us in a 5-minute intermission as we transition over. We have concluded item B1 on the business items agenda, which was the public draft of the signed ordinance. Good discussion. Thank you all, board. And now we'll move on to item B2, which is the September 2017 TOT report by our tourism manager.
Great, thank you, Chairman. So we've got the infographic up for you all to take a quick look at. This is the September year-over-year comparison. And our occupancy was slightly up. We were at 73%. Over last year was 71%. Looking at the, you know, we've talked about this several times, but looking at all our surrounding communities, it's just really interesting to see where everybody's numbers are falling. So I'm feeling fairly comfortable with where we are. We did have quite a bit of promotion in September. We had our wine promotion going on. We had some good size events. So the fact that we didn't see a bigger bump is a little disappointing, but you can see it countywide. It's just, it just was not moving very well. Can I answer any questions for you guys on the report?
Board, questions? No. Pretty straightforward. I was very happy to see a bump in occupancy. I was a little afraid. I know a lot of our fellow hoteliers, they've been pushing rate, really chasing that rate hard, which has possibly compromised occupancy. So to see the rate maybe soften a little bit to keep occupancy up, that is the game we all have to play, and continue to balance that out as things possibly shift a little bit. It was actually good to see. I was at the Central Coast Economic Forecast two Fridays ago now, presentation by Carolyn Batetta, the CEO of Visit California, about as big as it gets when it comes to tourism. She's a phenomenal woman, and she was forecasting as well a relatively reasonable year for 18 and 19 moving forward. I know that's been something we've all been concerned. So even at her 10,000 foot level, they're still showing some growth. So all good news. Seeing nothing else on the TOT report, board, is there any public comment? Seeing no public comment, we will close that section and then move on to item B3 on the agenda, which is the marketing and public relations update from our tourism manager. Take it
sure.
away, Jen.
Sure, I'm gonna go through some of the stats from Mental Marketing. So on their website, it was up for the month. Of course, like I said, we had Harbor Festival, Avocado Margarita we were promoting out that month, and the free bottle of wine. Interestingly enough, on the bottle of wine, we had two properties that took the offer and actually offered it out to any stay. They didn't use any sort of parameters. So if you booked on Expedia, if you stayed two nights, they gave you a bottle. And so their redemption was really high, and it has given me some other ideas on how to broaden this next year to get more hotels involved at a lower cost. So I'm going to bring that back to you next month and kind of show you a concept on how maybe we can make this even better for next September. So I think that'll be really good. Jackrabbit referrals were slightly down. So that, again, I'm reviewing websites right now and how are we going to rebuild it, and that is one of the things that we're looking at. There's not a lot of options, and if anybody wants to volunteer any information, you know, as far as other companies similar to Jackrabbit, I am looking at a couple, but I'll bring those to you probably in January on what we can do as far as website and is there a different booking mechanism that we would work better than Jackrabbit. Looking at their paid advertising stats, so they put on here 4 months, so you can kind of see where we sit on a monthly basis. And you'll notice on the media cost for September, it was significantly higher than the other months. And the reason why is because we had grant funds in there that were promoted through Mental Marketing for specific grants. So that's why you have that extra bump of money in there. Their click-through rates are looking, you know, pretty solid. October, our costs went up per click, and I would just say that's going into shoulder. That's typical of how shoulder looks. The one thing I've asked them to add on this, in this grid, is at the very end, put the topics that they were selling in those specific months so we can get a comparative, because, you know, when they're advertising in July, they're actually pushing out 2 months ahead. So I just asked them to give us kind of a topic list of what they're selling in those physical months so we can get a little better handle on how that looks.
Is there a good resource for from the hoteliers where like a typical lag or some sort of table that shows how many months out or how many days out an average booking is and how that shifts over time and where it spikes maybe at walk-in level?
That is a very good question, Mr. Green. So at a county level, we've set up a number of systems in place that are able to track this. It's damn right spooky, I'll actually tell you. So when you are in different websites looking at booking, and then it also geotags your location when you make the booking, then it also allows those that software to then understand when you actually go to that physical destination. So it truly can track when you're arriving, when you did the booking, and so forth. Yes, the GPS chips in these are very alive, and they are sending a lot of information out. So it really depends on the market. So at a county level, we are starting to change our marketing depending on what tier we are broadcasting to, the duration for that special. So in other words, some markets are 6 weeks in advance, others are 3 weeks in advance. So if we're running a special for, you know, December for Christmas, if that is a 6 week out market, we'll probably broadcast that in early October, late October. If it's a 3 week market, then we'll start broadcasting that in early December for Christmas. And that is just the level of detail that you can get into, and the rabbit hole gets deeper from there.
And then does that correlate with the timing of our email campaigns for individual, I'm subscribed to the list, and sometimes I wonder, is this the right time to send this email? And I just wonder if it correlates to that schedule in somehow.
Sure. And we have different, so kind of, let me go back on it a little bit. So as far as dry versus fly, which is our two major markets, Aaron's right that you can get really, really down that rabbit hole and divide it out pretty tightly, but for the most part, fly is running about 57 days out as far as booking, and then drive is 32. There's not enough airlift service coming into Morro Bay to warrant strong push for us on a fly market. We do have it, but it is not substantial compared to our drive. So drive is really where we focus. We focus 60 to like 30 days out, and then we run probably about, I would say, 10% actually day of bookings, and that's, you know, people just coming up on a whim. As far as our email campaign, Sean, you've got two different emails that go out, and one you're not seeing. So there's the large push that goes out to people outside of our list. That's like the LA Times, LA Magazine, USC's alumni list, those things like that that we purchase. And those are going 60 days out to those groups. So completely different group of people. The ones that you see come out of our office, and those do run closer because we're looking at kind of increasing when we feel soft. We're trying to increase for that upcoming usually week or 2 weeks, depending on how it looks. And our staff actively calls all the hotels. I'm sure they get tired of us making phone calls all the time, but it really helps for us to know how the bookings are looking. When, I mean, literally we're a week out and we're coming up on Harbor Festival. You know, are we only at 70% or are we at 95%? And we make adjustments according to that on what we want to push if we're not seeing the numbers. Does that help a little bit? Okay. It's not very black and white, and it changes every month, and how people's pocketbooks look and where payroll, you know, sits on the month compared to coming into a weekend. I mean, there's so many variables, and some months have 5 weekends, some have 3.5. I mean, it's never ending changing, which I like. I think it's fun to be able to look at it and you know, manipulate it all the time. So that's kind of all I wanted to talk about on their stats. You know, I'm just trying to really watch what they're doing financially and see if we can move those numbers up higher, especially going into shoulder. We do have some campaign assets that we've started this year, which is the video portions that we're doing that run up on YouTube, and we're getting huge response on those. So those are just 15-second clips that we've bought, and we're combining offers. It's not selling just one event or one specific weekend. We only have enough to do about 10 of those during the year, and so we're trying to sell usually two different things that are kind of going on in the market coming into maybe like 30 to 60 days out. Good? Okay. Some of the other campaign asset developments that they did during the month, so the fall shoulder campaign, they started running that in August 15th. Sean, so this kind of talks more about what you're asking as far as selling, you know, farther out, and that was for the free wine with your two-night stay. Very high impressions, good click-through, the landing page. So that one of the challenges we have is, you know, once you're off of Jackrabbit and you go on to individual hotel sites, we can't track if they're actually booking. But so we've set up these landing pages so we can see if people are actually clicking from our ads onto morrobay.org specifically for an offer and look at those hotels that are in those offers. So our landing page was clicking through really well for mid-August to mid-October for that promotion. And then we started launching the winter campaign, which is the kids get free stuff. I'm really excited with how it's doing. So last year, just to remind you guys, we did a kind of a test. It was our first passport that we did, and we did them internally. We didn't spend money on printing. We just wanted to see if we would have traction or not going through November, December, which is high travel tourism time of year with all the holidays and the vacations coming up during school, and we got really good traction. So this year, it's a really strong book. It has over $140 in offers, and it's doing really well. I've talked with some of the retailers, and they're seeing good redemptions in just the first couple weeks. So I think having something that's an added value that doesn't cost the hotels any money, obviously that's the slam dunk, right? We all know that. So that's doing really well too. And that's what I want to talk about as far as their campaigns. And I'm going to talk a little bit about their PR that they did for us in October. Do you guys have any questions on the assets? No? So they put together the complete PR book, and you guys are welcome to. They've got all the click-throughs. You can go on any of the different press releases that they have. But a couple that I wanted to show you, LA Magazine picked up the Oyster story, which was really good. So this LA Magazine is one of the companies that we bought their mailing list and that we're pushing out to on their mailing list. And so this was really nice that they picked up a story as well, because it's that top of mind. If their customers are seeing an email that comes through and there's a story, it just helps us push through a little stronger. And then the other interesting thing, so we started getting calls from the state park that the butterflies came back early this year, which is really interesting. I mean, they were here like in September, which is very early. So mental, I asked them to do a quick release on that, and we went up and took photos of where they were, and it got picked up really, really strongly. So that was a really nice extra kind of PR push that we didn't know we were going to have, and it did really well for us. It got picked up on quite a few different publications. So that's all I have. You have any questions on their PR before I go into another thing? Any public comment?
I'm taking over my job, Jen. That's what I do up here. I say public comment, then I say next item. Board, seriously, no questions for her? Any public comment? Seeing none. All right. Item B4, a sponsorship opportunity for the World Surf League in March.
So this is an interesting opportunity that came in about 30 days ago, and this group, they are the group that are doing the surf contest in Pismo Beach actually this weekend, which is why they're not here today. They're actually, today is their setup day, and the contest starts tomorrow, so that just was not possible for him to be here. So kind of, I'll give you kind of an outline as I know it from the surf industry and kind of how it works. You have to go through different levels before you become a professional surfer. And so you have to go to these meets, the WSL meets wherever they are, and you have to qualify to move up and finally become a pro surfer. One of the biggest challenges that they have is most of the World Surf League events are out of the country. They're in Costa Rica, Panama, and you're talking about usually high school or college age families that are trying to travel and help their kids, accomplish what they want to do, and the cost is very high. So currently there are two qualifying meets down in Southern California. They're both held in Huntington Beach. And so Andy, who is, he's based out of Pismo, he's the one that has brought the WSL up here, and he's really vying to do four events up here in Central and Northern California. He has, like I said, Pismo this week, then he's hoping to come to Morro Bay, possibly Ventura and Santa Cruz. So those are his four goal cities to have events in, and he would like to do this yearly. When I talked with him, so the Pismo contest is a 3-day contest, and he kind of explained to me how it worked, and basically you have to go through qualifying, and every day you can get knocked out and you're not competing the next day. So the group does move to a smaller group by day three. You just have your probably final, I think, six contestants on the third day, but it does require multiple days here. It fits into our shoulder season push, which is key to me. And the really nice thing is the Pismo contest, which is 3 days, does not include a women's event. And the Morro Bay one would. So there's a fourth day just dedicated to women. So that gives us a 4-day event, which is helpful, especially in March. So that's kind of what it's about. I attached his overview for you to look at. He's got different categories for sponsorship, and you know, none of them really fit where I would like us to be. And what I was looking at was he has one on here that says double booth space sponsorship for $5,000. I don't know about you guys, but I don't really feel we need a booth at the event. I think what we need is we need to be on their websites beforehand to get the bookings here. So if you guys approve it, I would recommend that we approve it with the caveat that we need to have morrowbay.org link on their websites actively to help us push overnight stays. The other thing that if you would like to have me attend their contest this weekend, I'd be glad to go down there and check it out. And if you want me to just make my decision after that and how I feel the contest looks and the quality and as far as people attending, I'm willing to do that as well. So I'm kind of leaving it open to you guys, whatever you think. I think it's a huge opportunity for us.
Jen, where would the heat or the competition in Morro Bay be? To the right of the rock there?
Yes, it would be to the right of the rock, and they set up in the back of the parking lot is where they would put their grandstand. They've got this grandstand that's built out of container ships. It's pretty cool looking, and so they'd put it back there.
When Santa Cruz, they're a big deal when they're visible, and there's quite a bit of vendor, you know, food trucks, clothing. So it is, a lot of people attend these just to watch, not only the contestants.
And he would be doing that as well, Stephen. It's really important this first year that he gets enough sponsorship. He's a little concerned about financially having enough sponsors right now is where his head is. So even if you approve it, it still might not happen. We'll have to just see how he is financially.
I like the idea of trusting you after you see what's actually happening at this event. $5,000 seems somewhat reasonable if it feels like a sound event. Maybe there's an opportunity if you don't feel like we need a double booth sponsor but still want to give $5,000, that there could be an opportunity to contribute that $5,000 and then reach out to one, two, or even four other Morro Bay events and comp their booth space to encourage them to go, whether it's the Morro Bay Triathlon or some other event like that, to give them that space on our dime. I don't know.
The idea of working with other nonprofits that are promoting other events in the future, it should be really that anyone who gets a grant, mandatory that our morrowbay.org is on their website. I think that should be a solid. Every single time we give a dime, we get linked to their site. So that's
good. Actually, a follow-up on Charlie's comment, which I agree with. I almost think that it should be mandatory that if you're asking for grant money, you come to the TBID meeting and also have a follow-up to let us know how it went. I particularly appreciate a recent follow-up that we got from someone who we gave grant money to, and they had an incident or two, but they had a great follow-up, and we actually got some feedback, so I thought that was valuable.
Let me give you guys a couple points on that. So right now, our grants are closed. We do not have our grant season open right now. It is a requirement in the grants that they do include the booking link clearly and prominently on everything that they do. This would go under sponsorships. I do still have sponsorship money available. I was holding back some funds, assuming that we might have Amgen coming back through, and I didn't want to be short, so I do have the ability to put this through on a sponsorship. And that's where it would have to sit, because like I said, we don't have grants open right now. Oh, I have one more thing. Also for grants, Sean, just so you're aware, so they have to give a final report to me, and I just have not put them all together for you. So I will do that, and we'll have to go through all of them and review them again and decide, you know, for next year as well.
One point of clarification, you might already know this. I know, again, going back to the reference of Santa Cruz for Mavericks, it's not based on a time. It's when the waves are suitable. So it's hard to market that in advance. Do you know how this would be set up if it came to fruition?
I think that is more with the professional contests. I don't know that the amateur contests, that they move them based on quality of surf.
As a lifelong surfer myself, I can testify that early March is not too terribly bad. There'll be decent lefts coming off the rock right there. So it'd be as good as any other time. Good thoughts, board. You took a lot of my questions right out of my mouth. I think absolutely with them doing the event this weekend, Jen, if you can, I may even shoot down to PISM myself and just check it out and see how professionally it's done. That's a great representation. So I think that our vote today naturally would be contingent upon one of us at least witnessing them in action, see how together Mr. McKay is. Sponsorship of $5,000 seems very reasonable. I also, in reading this material last night, this Deep Blue Events, they're very eco-conscious. They're looking for sustainable events, which absolutely meets the identity for Morro Bay. So I'm all for this. One question, board. Of course, since we're, in this case, we're advocating, we all seem to be on page for a double booth sponsorship of $5,000. You guys mentioned if we paid for a booth, I feel like we should use the booth space for something. You guys mentioned another nonprofit, but first, should we just open it up to our constituency, our hoteliers, and see if they want any of that booth space first before we go out to the nonprofit community? That seems like a better fit, and then we're presenting value to the hoteliers. If they decline, then perhaps nonprofits would be second. You guys agree or disagree? Thoughts on that? I mean, there's going to be a lot of last-minute people coming to town to check out the surf contest, need a room, and if there's a booth there, I think the hotel could maybe capture some of that.
Yeah, we had a booth at the concerts, just so you know. We had a morrobay.org booth, and we served quite a few people with information, visitors, but nothing directly related to booking a room. But we were there, and a lot of people picked up visitor guides and information.
Okay. All right. You are looking for... I don't actually see a vote on here. Are you looking for a motion then, Jen? Excuse me. Oh, forgive me, on the actual staff report then. Board, do we have any further discussion on this? Okay, we'd like to open up to public comment. Is there any public comment? Seeing no public comment. All right, we're going to be looking for a motion, gentlemen. I think that we are in agreement with... Now, I can't make the motion, but I think we're discussing using the booth space, possibly for hoteliers, morrobay.org or something, correct? Or even the chamber, something nonprofit. Let's start with our primary constituency first. So that's one portion. We're also looking at somebody for visual confirmation of the event over this weekend. Like I said, I may shoot down there myself. Is there anything else we wanted to add to that?
All right. I'll motion to approve $5,000 sponsorship contingent upon positive observation of this weekend's Pismo Beach event and the use of the double booth space TBD. Depending on Jennifer Little's recommendations.
Sounds like a good motion. I like it, Sean. So 8 out of 10.
Do we have a second? I'll second that.
All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Just to clarify, we would open up the booth space first to hoteliers, second to something that promotes Morro Bay, chamber, et cetera, correct?
Yes, that's what I took away.
Got it.
And was that an aye, Stephen? Okay, so we are 4-0. Motion passes unanimously. Almost done. Are there any declaration of future items we would like to see on future agendas, discussion, topic, or education? Seeing none, we will conclude today's meeting and adjourn. It is exactly 10:31 a.m. Thank you all. Makes it official.